This is the Mobile Tech Podcast, brought to you by worldpodcasts.com. Now here's your host, Tech Girl, Miriam Joie.
Hi, and welcome to the Mobile Tech Podcast. Today is Tuesday, June 13th, and I have a very special guest on. Somebody that I've known for years now, and that's been working at Microsoft forever. My friend Greg Sullivan is on. Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm very well, Miriam. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
You are my first non-journalist on the show, so that's exciting, right?
Very.
So you and I go back quite a ways. I can't remember how we met, but maybe you do. This is probably a trade show thing.
It was either at a trade show or at an event in San Francisco where we were talking about phone stuff back in the day.
Yes, it's always about phones somehow. How does that happen? So anyway, I wanted to kind of go through some of the news items. There's been a few very exciting Microsoft-related announcements this week. Well, this weekend with the Xbox One X and with the Surface laptop reviews that came out overnight, like this morning, Tuesday, when you get this podcast, of course, it'll be Thursday or something. And so you're a tech nerd like me. You like everything about it. I think that's kind of why we hit it off.
Yes.
What's your take on the Xbox One X? Like, it's the most powerful console supposedly ever made.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I think as a gamer and just as a customer, not as a Microsoft employee, I'm very excited. I recently replaced the TV in my family room that I had for this is going to tell you a little bit about me. I had this TV for 21 years.
Wow!
It was one of the original high def TVs. It was a Sony 36 inch flat screen tube. It was still a CRT. I just recently got rid of a 500 pound CRT. But as I tell people, when you grow up in the Great Depression, you learn the value of a dollar. So I'm kind of a cheapskate. But in any case, I had that TV for a while. It was again, one of the very first TVs capable of this was just 1080i only. It wasn't a 1080p device. But it was a high definition television, and it was quality back in the day. But I knew that this was the point at which it made a lot of sense to upgrade, make the phase transition. It was, and my wife will tell you that it was long past time to upgrade instead of keeping that old beast going, the CRT.
Was it CRT? Oh wow!
It was the flat screen. It was one of the last tube TVs that you would see going into anybody's houses. And there's part of me, if you look in my attic, you'll see the original IBM PC clone that I built myself back in the mid 80s.
Right.
That is still in my attic because someday I'll boot that thing up and play with it just to take pride in the fact that I replaced some capacitors and it still boots.
See, this is what I like about you, Greg. I replaced some capacitors. I can relate to this.
Oh, this was a funny story. I was working at a computer company that sold hard cards. Remember back, the original IBM PC didn't come with a hard drive.
That's right.
And so there was a cottage industry that developed out of companies bolting a 3.5 inch half height 20 megabyte hard drive onto aluminum rails combined with like a Western Digital controller, a hard disk controller, because those were not built into the system board obviously back then. And this company used to sell those by the boatload. And I was a technician on the repair bench there, good old Orion Computer Products. And there was another guy who had plugged in the power supply of the original IBM PC with the offset. He plugged the power supply into the motherboard wrong, and the 12 volts went in the 6 volts, and the 6 volts went in the 12 volts. And so he turned it on, and there was this huge pop and a puff of smoke up from the tech bench. And I looked over and said, boy, that ain't good. And they threw away the system board because clearly it was fried. And I looked at this big green capacitor on there, and I said to myself, boy, I wonder
if it's just
if it's just that. And sure enough, I took out the bad capacitor and soldered in a new one. And that PC was my main computer for quite a while. And yes, it is still in my attic, probably with a family of mice living in it. But
you know, it's funny because a lot of older electronics today that use switching power supplies, like that original PC, because back then that was state of the art. Now everything is switching power supplies. But, you know, the capacitors are going bad in the like 20, 30, 40, 50 years later. 50 is probably much. But I have an old iMac G5 that still works like a charm. I mean, it's a G5. It's not even competitive to today's Macs. But the only thing that was wrong with it was all the capacitors, all the, you know, the electrolytics had gone bad on the motherboard. And all I did was buy a kit on eBay of all the, you know, capacitors all sorted together, nice high quality Japanese ones, and I just soldered them in, and the thing booted right up. And so if you have an old device that uses a switching power supply and doesn't want to start or is acting wonky, that's generally all you have to do. Learn to solder and go nuts.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and for those of us who take pride in keeping old technology running longer than it absolutely should, that's a fun thing to do.
For sure. So tell me about the Xbox. So you're upgrading the TV first.
Yeah, that's what we were talking. That's what we were talking about.
This is exactly what I loved about this show, is that the tangents are rampant. So you were going to, we're talking about, we're going to get to the Xbox One X, but you're getting a new TV. So tell us about that.
So I got a new TV, and I, you know, looked at what was available, and I didn't want to go, you know, completely nuts, but I wanted to get something that, if not lasting another 21 years, would at least get me through through the next kind of generation of tech. And so, of course, I got a 4K UHD TV.
Right.
And the exciting thing for me now is that as the Xbox One X becomes available later this year, that's going to be driving my experience in the living room. And one of the things that was most exciting about this week's announcements was all of the, you know, the content updates and the free 4K upgrades that that Phil had mentioned. So I already have an experience where I watch just typical you know, HD content on this new screen, and it's just demonstrably better than, you know, what was my state of the art 20-year-old TV.
Yeah. What did you end up getting? Can you tell us?
I got another Sony. Actually, I was looking at the Samsungs, I was looking at LGs, I was looking at a whole bunch, and in part because of how long the last Sony lasted me.
Right.
I got another Sony.
I have a friend who lives in Tahoe who used to work with me in video games, and this is also why I'm excited about the Xbox One X, is because I used to be a video game developer, like write code for 15 years in video games.
Right.
So I keep an ear to the ground what's happening in the biz. And, you know, it's like I went to E3 for like 15 years until I finally stopped. But he has a home in Tahoe. He worked with me at one of the studios, and he was one of the first people back then in 2002 to buy a plasma flat screen TV.
Right.
And I believe he's still using it. I mean, those things are so high quality. I mean, it was $20,000 when he bought it or something ridiculous.
Right.
And it's still, I think it was a Pioneer, and it's still ticking. And even today, this thing, I mean, it's only, you know, 720p, I think, or something. But right, you give it, you look at it today, and it's still like, wow. Like, you know, of course, it uses as much power as a fridge. But,
right,
you know, tiny little cathode ray tubes and arranged in a row is an expensive proposition.
Right.
But it goes to tell you how sometimes spending the money, you know, pays off, I guess. Maybe this one is a little low of a payoff, 20K for 720p 20 years ago. Yeah. But, you know, I think you got a better deal there with your Sony rear projection flat panel, whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it a gigantic CRT?
It was a gigantic CRT. That's why the thing weighed 500 pounds. I mean, maybe it was only 350 pounds, but in either case,
you couldn't lift it by yourself. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you don't want
Xbox One X. I mean, couple of things that stood out for me. Obviously, you know, I'm a big car nut, right? So
yes.
Forza? No, what is it? The 7. The car racing game. It's Forza, right?
Yeah, Forza.
Forza 7 I found it interesting that they chose E3 to announce the kind of like marquee car, which was the Porsche 911 GT2 RS.
Yes.
And that Porsche kind of denied it. Like, you know, I don't know if you follow this, but in the car blogs yesterday, people are like, so Porsche kind of announced the GT2 RS yesterday, but kind of didn't confirm it really officially. Yet Microsoft sounds like it's a real thing. So it was really interesting. but it's got me excited about obviously Forza. And of course, the other thing that I noticed that was interesting is there's no Kinect port. Apparently, I could be wrong, but
On the Xbox One X.
Yeah,
I'm not. And again, I can't speak for the Xbox team, and that's something that we'd have to follow up.
I don't use Kinect, so it's just interesting to me that, you know, we're look back 5 years and Kinect was like the future, right? And at least on this one, supposedly there's no port for it, so maybe it's using a different port. Who knows? But those are the two things that, you know, I'm excited. I mean, what are the games that you're looking forward to playing in 4K?
Well, I have to say I've dabbled. A lot of what I've done is, I played through a lot of the, I've spent a lot of hours in Oblivion and in, that whole series.
Oh, yeah.
And I played Just Cause 3, just compelling. I just devoted myself to that and went through the whole thing. One of the things I'm most interested is in Minecraft, actually, and in seeing what is going to be possible with a 4K Minecraft and the kinds of worlds that people will create. It's going to be pretty amazing.
You know, I feel the same way. I think that's kind of going to be the unrespected 4K title, right? Like, at least, you know, I think a lot of us are going to get excited about it, but we're going to see a lot of people go, oh, come on, Minecraft in 4K, are you crazy? That's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, I think, you know, people associated with it kind of that throwback 8-bit chunky graphics look and feel. But I think one of the exciting things will be to see what the team has done to take advantage of the power that Xbox One X brings to the table and what you can do in 4K with something like that. The kinds of worlds that people can create. It talks to this notion of one of the things that's, and this is back to our earlier discussion that you and I had about kind of my long time at Microsoft and what are some of the things that have changed. And, you know, this idea that, we have a very clear evolution of our mission statement about enabling and empowering people to achieve stuff. And the idea and the naming of Windows 10, the creators update, this notion of creation is a really powerful idea. And I think Minecraft is another great example. It's all about creation, this idea that you can go in and create your own world. And one of the things that's really exciting about that is just the creativity and the open-endedness of it. And so combining the advancements in power that we'll see with Xbox One X, with that idea that you've given these tools to go out and just create these fantastical worlds, is something that's going to be fun to see and experience.
It's funny, you know, the other thing that kind of like, you know, my nerd kind of got, you know, titillated by was the 6 teraflops compute power and the vapor evaporation cooling. You know, if I worked at, and this is, you know, don't get mad at me, but I worked at Sony Computer Entertainment of America for 2 years in the mid-2000s, around the time the PlayStation 3 was king of the hill in the Sony universe.
Right.
And the reason I took the job, it was an evangelist job, a developer evangelist job, where I went around teaching and, in you know, preaching about the platform, primarily for audio, because they had, HDMI output with audio support, which at the time was nobody had. And you could do 8-channel audio, like you could do surround audio right from the PlayStation 3. So for me, it was super exciting. But I took the job in part because coding on the PlayStation 3 was a total disaster. I mean, it was such a challenge. It was so difficult because of cell processor and stuff that to me, I wanted to learn, like, you know, the challenge was what got me going. But if you look at my history as a game developer, my most fun and exciting moments as a dev were always on Xbox. And, you know, it's funny to see now that, you know, sure, you know, the Xbox One X just came out. The PlayStation 4 Pro is a few months old. But it's funny for me to see that for the first time, you know, indubitably, the Xbox is king of the hill in terms of hardware and specs and numbers, right? I don't think that's happened in a while. So it's like, wow, what a world we live in. If you had told me when I was working at Sony that I'd see a console in the next 5 years or whatever it was, it's more than 5 years now, but that I'd see a console with 6 teraflops, I would have like, yeah, right. I really don't. I honestly didn't think that 4K would become a thing as quickly as it did. And as soon as you start having that kind of pixel pushing to do, right, you pretty much need that kind of horsepower, right?
Right, and folks know that, you know, in terms of kind of raw performance, that PC gaming is kind of the place where...
Oh, right. That's how I started, you know,
the ceiling, PC gaming. Yeah, the ceiling is higher there because you'll have folks going out and being able to take advantage of the latest and greatest in, you know, primarily GPU offerings, but also the entire systems that you can build for a gaming rig. And they certainly cost more than... you know,
a console.
The console. Yeah. Yeah. And so as one of my physics professors told me one time, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. So if you want if you want that power, it's going to be a more expensive game. And the PC gaming space gives you that headspace. There's you know, there's a high ceiling there in terms of the type of device that you can build and the raw power that it has. Yeah. But this is exciting because now in the console space, you'll have something. And clearly, I think, you know, what you saw this week with the way the team has positioned this is that Xbox One X is not necessarily the console for everyone.
Oh, no.
That power. Yeah.
Yeah. And people are kind of complaining that, well, maybe not complaining, but I've started seeing a bit of complaining out there about, oh, the price. And I'm like, okay, look, yes, it's expensive for a console, but $500 is still not expensive. You couldn't build a PC with these specs at that price. I don't think, I might be wrong, but I think it's going to be tough to reach that level of performance in a really tightly integrated way.
No, that's a great point.
With the kind of power consumption and cooling that you're seeing in Xbox One X for $500 if you built your own. And that's kind of the whole point. Like, a lot of people, you know, my first game that I worked on for almost 3 years was Homeworld, the real-time strategy game, published by Sierra Online back in the day. We did that when I worked at Relic Entertainment in Vancouver in the mid to late 90s. And, you know, it was a like huge, huge award-winning game and, you know, certainly put me on the map in my career as video game developer because I made the audio engine for that along with my colleague Shane at the time. And the reason people were like, why do you mean you're moving on? Like, I left the company to work on consoles. Like, what do you mean you're moving on to consoles? PC gaming is where it's at. And I'm like, yes, it is. But there is no challenge there for me. Like, the hardware does all the work. Like, it just keeps getting better. And to me, what I was excited about when I started working on PlayStation 2, Xbox original, I did actually a launch title on the original Xbox. And I'm very tight with the original Xbox team because, you know, they were still finalizing the SDK it was called the XDK then.
Right.
And you know, I needed some features that implemented. First of all, Microsoft was way more responsive than Sony or Nintendo ever were at getting us what we needed as developers. And secondly, and that's always been true with Microsoft. And then secondly, you know, going from PC to consoles was really challenging because I had to make things work on finite hardware that was going to stay finite for 5 years, right?
Right.
So as a developer, to me, that was actually more challenging. So I think that in a way, the Xbox One X is the best of both worlds because you have kind of like that incredible raw horsepower that's going to last 5 years, but it's already so high, right, that you are going to be able to basically do, you know, very similar, if not better than PC gaming on this console for the next little while, right?
Yeah.
And that's like, wow.
Well, I think one of the underlying themes I think that is not highlighted as much is the, you know, you talk about the development platform, and one of the things that we have talked about a little bit, but I don't think has gotten as much attention is the benefits that we're deriving from a platform standpoint on this kind of one core effort that our operating system team underwent over the last many years. Kind of the rationalizing the multiple various platforms that we had across, you know, from embedded devices and phones and IoT and desktops and servers and gaming consoles. And, you know, I think it's lost on most people that now the with Windows 10, we have a platform that spans that entire range of devices, and we can have, you know, we talked about the phone conversation, which is another thing altogether, but it's still relevant. And in the idea that there is not just from a kind of kernel architecture standpoint, you have the fundamental OS subsystems, which having those consistent or in fact identical across this range of device types certainly has engineering efficiency benefits for Microsoft, because we don't have to kind of target and rebuild for multiple platforms. But the benefits that has to developers and ultimately to the users of these platforms, I think are only just beginning to become apparent to people. And so the notion that you'll be able to write universal Windows programs that will run across this range of hardware, and I can have games on my PC, and we know that that's the PC gaming community is a thriving and growing group, and so there's a ton of interesting work going on there. But the work that was done on the operating system architecture standpoint to rationalize our multiple platforms is going to pay off dividends for not just, again, Microsoft internally, for our whole partner ecosystem, for the broad ISV community, and for end users. It reminds me of a discussion that I remember you know, Bill Gates talking about years ago, is this vision of the disaggregation of the PC. Like we think about these devices that we sit in front of, and just because of the way that it manifests today is not necessarily the way it's going to stay. You have display, input, output, storage, processing, all local. And we're already seeing this notion that we're kind of abstracting the storage from the I/O, from the processing, and having a platform that enables kind of this broad array of devices to participate and deliver experiences to you, again, that can go from one device to the other. We're going to start to see some really exciting things. So as a game developer, for example, you know that you have to kind of reinvest and pay a tax for each additional platform that you target.
For sure.
And, you know, we've heard in the industry of this, you know, this idea of writing, you know, leveraging your code across as many different execution environments as possible has been the holy grail for a long time. And we've seen all kinds of abstraction layers and emulators and things that were going to solve that problem broadly. But I think, you know, from our standpoint, if we've architected our underlying platform such that the same code can run across such an array of devices and kind of, you know, modify and the user interface appropriately just based on the device that it's running on. It's a pretty powerful thing, especially as we look toward the future, the kinds of experiences we want to enable.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think this is, you know, this is one of the strengths. It's also in a way a challenge because, you know, you want to make sure you don't have like a lowest common denominator kind of situation. Thankfully, exactly. I think you guys have managed that really well. And I think that, you know, that's I think what makes Microsoft innovative as a company. It's always been about the developers, developer tools, and the technologies brought to the table. If you don't mind, I want to switch gears a little bit because we already talked quite a while here about the Xbox, and I want to talk about a bunch of other stuff. Yeah. I'm going to squeeze in a few news items for the next few, just 2-3 minutes. Just want to make sure that the readers, listeners, go get their fix. I did my HTC U11 review, which is HTC's new flagship phone. It's up on chipchick.com. That's the website I write phones reviews for, chip, like a computer chip, chick, like a little chicken.com. Check it out. And the takeaway for me is a really great phone, lacks a headphone jack, which is a bit vexing. You'll read in detail why. It's not so much an issue usually because an adapter solves the problem, but in this case, it's an issue simply because the adapter provided isn't that great compared to what HTC delivered on its previous phones. So if you're an audio enthusiast, look somewhere else. But in every other way, I think this is a fantastic device. So that's my takeaway. Have you had a chance to play with any of these new fancy Android phones, Greg? I know that a bunch of them came out, Galaxy S8, LG G6, Pixel last year. Are you playing with these at all?
I have. I've played with the mostly played with the Galaxy S8. The I'm interested in some of the new ones that are coming out. I think it's I saw a lot of the coverage of what Andy Rubin is doing, and that looks
Essential.
Looks pretty compelling. Yeah, the Essential looks like a really interesting project, and I like a lot of people look forward to playing with that one.
It's funny you brought that up, because that's actually a great segue into one of the news items for this week, which is that the Essential phone is coming to Sprint as an exclusive, very much like the HTC U11, which is sold either on Sprint in the US or unlocked by HTC. This is the first HTC phone that actually isn't sold on all four carriers by the carriers themselves. I mean, you can obviously use it on Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile if you buy the unlocked version. And I believe HTC has a purchase plan to make it a monthly payment with no interest if you want. But at the same time, it's like the Essential. It's a phone that Sprint seems to be picking up, the cool phones. Or I should say, another cynical view of looking at it is they're not able to make inroads with Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile to carry their phones. I'm a bit conflicted with Essential only going with Sprint, because it's unfortunately not the best network, in my opinion. But more importantly, it kind of pigeonholes them a little bit. Like, it's like, oh, we needed a carrier agreement and we managed to get Sprint, kind of like a consolation price almost. I would have almost thought they should have just stayed unlocked and make it, you know, compatible with Sprint. That way, you know, they're kind of like neutral. But I know that that doesn't work very well in the US still. You know, for a while, we've been, you know, hoping that with Apple kind of like showing the way of what a manufacturer of phones should do in terms of owning the experience, right? And not having dictate the experience. I think we're just not seeing the others follow through. Like Samsung, obviously still in bed with the carriers big time, because they should have, they need to, right? But you look at OnePlus, they're purposely doing unlocked. You look at Essential, I thought they were going to do only unlocked. HTC's switching to unlocked, only has Sprint left. Of course, LG is still in bed with the carriers somehow. What's your take on that? I mean, would you buy an unlocked versus a carrier branded device? I mean, you know that there are drawbacks and advantages to both. Your take?
Yeah, no, you're right. The US market is interesting still in this way, the sway that that the carriers have, and they have as you say, it's all about the trade-offs. And again, even, you know, from a phone manufacturer standpoint, getting ranged and having getting ranged on a particular carrier is there's a lot that goes into those negotiations and the back and forth, and the trade-offs that are made by someone choosing to have an exclusive arrangement with a carrier are certainly well understood around here. I think, you know, we had a lot of, in the Lumia days, we did a bunch of work with AT&T, and they were a fantastic partner, but there was certainly tremendous benefits to having them range our devices and the ones that were exclusive there. But again, those were decisions. Those were trade-offs, because the U.S. market has some very interesting aspects that we don't see in the rest of the world. And so those trade-offs have to be taken into consideration. I myself am more likely to buy the unlocked one.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably true of a lot of folks who fancy themselves gadget nerds, as we have embraced the moniker, you and I both. And I think, that's a trend that we'll see continue. It's certainly got a lot of momentum around the world, and we'll see what happens. But that would be my preference.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest gripe right now, it's not so much that I want people to be able to go to the AT&T or Verizon or T-Mobile or Sprint store and buy the phone they want. I have no issues with that. I think it certainly is very much a nice thing to be able to walk into your carrier store, if their carriers are going to insist on having stores, and physically look at the device and play with it. My biggest gripe is that if I pick up an iPhone at Sprint or Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile, it's an iPhone. There's no crud. There's no branding. There's no weird stuff. I buy a Galaxy from Verizon, and I mentioned this in my Galaxy S8 review, or buy it from T-Mobile, some of the Samsung features have been disabled by Verizon. You know, so I think Essential, obviously, is going to remain very pure. And I have to say, you'll read in my review, the U11, the HTC phone I just reviewed, has very little crud on it from Sprint. Kudos to them to work it out. But what I really want to see is Galaxy, Samsung, LG, all these players, you know, basically sell their phones completely with no strings attached through the carriers. And yeah, maybe if you want this carrier fidelity, like this stick with us kind of mentality, you want to lock the phones and then make them unlocked when they're paid off, perhaps. But I think it shouldn't go beyond that. And that's basically what the iPhones are like. There's no crud. There's no carrier software. It's just it's locked to the carrier if you buy it from the carrier. And when your payment plan is over, you get to unlock it. That to me would be the ideal kind of middle ground, right?
Right.
The ideal is people smarten up and start buying unlocked phones from Amazon, Best Buy, and the manufacturers directly in the same way as they buy a car. You know, I mean, you don't buy a car that only takes Shell gas and only drives on Shell roads. Like, that's kind of ridiculous, right?
Yeah. I think the combination of the carrier subsidy of the hardware and folks kind of thinking that they were getting these phones, you know, quote unquote, for free without actually realizing that there was a bunch of factors that went into kind of the financing of that device. The principle that you know, I think we try to adhere to, and I think it's should be kind of universally true, is what is it like to be the person holding this thing in your hand? And
right.
if we take the... If all of us, the industry, I mean, the carriers, hardware manufacturers, software providers, if we take the view that first and foremost, and let's primarily concern ourselves with what it's like to be the, you know, the poor guy using the thing, that then you come from the right place. And if there are benefits to, you know, having a carrier locked phone, and there clearly have been benefits from a subsidization standpoint and from
definitely yeah.
from other areas, you know, customizations of the ROMs, and there's certainly unique benefits to having something that's tweaked for a particular network, but there are also obviously advantages to having the freedom of an unlocked device. If I go overseas and I want to pop another SIM card in my GSM phone, I shouldn't have to ask my carrier's permission to be able to use the device on a network overseas. And so those kinds of trade-offs have been part of the equation. But I think, again, just getting back to the principle of the end user experience, and we get caught up in the complexities of, especially in the phone space, because you have the carriers, OEMs of the devices, you have the carriers, and you have the channel. There's a whole set of layers of complexity. But if you can get kind of wrapped up in that, and from where I sit, if we think first and foremost about the person, what's it like to be the person using this, and what are the challenges that they face, and what are the things that they like about a given approach, I think that's going to be the best guidance.
Yeah, I think, look, I'm not adverse to maybe you buy a Sprint you go to the Sprint store and buy an iPhone, for example. Right now, it's not going to, it's not going to install any Sprint software, but it's going to have it's going to have like basically a carrier package it downloads that optimizes the phone for that carrier, right? That's to me what it should be like.
Right.
It's like, and if that phone is unlocked and you stick an AT&T SIM in it, Apple will download the AT&T carrier package to give you a better experience on AT&T. And this is completely seamless to the user. And I think this is the way to go. I'd even be willing, if Samsung wanted to go this direction, and they did it on the T-Mobile one, which was really cool, where if you pop your SIM in, it pops up a thing that says, hey, would you like to download a few of the T-Mobile apps?
Right.
Like, it asks you first.
Yeah.
And you choose to do it. It does it in one bundle. You don't have to go to the App Store and install all the little T-Mobile apps that you're maybe used to or want to use. But the other thing what vexes me is when you get a phone and there's like five or six, carrier apps like that are actually maybe useful, like your voicemail app and whatever. And then you have like Amazon's suite of apps. And like, I love Amazon, but like, I don't want all of them. And right. I don't need all, like, I mean, maybe the Kindle app and the Alexa app, since I have a few Echoes floating around, but you know, it's like, yeah, this is my grief. It's like, and you know this about the PC space, the bundle software issue, right?
Right.
For a long time, that was a way to make money and to differentiate. But I think it's kind of user hostile, because you're making assumptions about what they want and what they'll use. And you're looking at the bottom line before, as you said, that person's experience, right? I want to just, because I touched on it, and I don't want to, like, I want to close the loop on it. I talked about OnePlus. There's been a lot of rumors and a lot of leaks about the OnePlus 5, which is their next flagship, which is supposed to be revealed on June 20th. I'm keeping my mouth shut because I know things I can't talk about. But at the same time, you should really tune in for next week's podcast, is all I'm going to say, because I think it's going to be all about the OnePlus 5. Because it'll come out right after the news is made and the announcements are made. So we'll have a lot to discuss. I'm really excited about the company and what they've been doing in the phone space. Just like Essential, they're really kind of doing really high-end devices. I think their shtick, though, has been affordable high-end, which is badly needed, I think. Have you ever played with a OnePlus phone?
I have briefly. My son's girlfriend has one. And so I've had a chance to play with it, and she loves it, and it's a very nice rig.
Yeah, it's not bad for the money. So speaking of laptops, I mean, we talked about, we can go back to talking about phones, but I want to talk a bit about, you know, you said, we talked about, I just mentioned CRUD on laptops and pre-installed software. Surface laptop embargo lifted last night at midnight Pacific, I think. And it's out in the wild. The reviews are out and they're overwhelmingly positive, which has got me very excited. I mean, I played with it very briefly because Joe Belfiore had his at Microsoft Build, and he was kind enough to let me just take it for a spin really quickly, type on the keyboard, use the trackpad, you know, touch the touchscreen. And this was on his own machine with his own account. Very, very, very nice guy to let me do this. And I don't want to get him in trouble for it. But obviously, he had shut down any significantly scary apps that I shouldn't be seeing.
Right.
But it was just 10 seconds. And it was awesome. I loved it. It's very light. You know, it's interesting. Dieter Bohn reviewed it for The Verge and said, you know, in terms of design, if the, you know, if the MacBook Air is like a Porsche, like all curves, the Surface laptop is like a Lamborghini, all angles. And I think that's true. That's what it feels like. It's a bit thick if you think about the fact that, you know, it doesn't look thick, but it is a little thick simply because the wedge shape kind of hides some of the thickness. It's not really thick. Today's standards, you know, everything is super thin, obviously. But it feels, because of that, it has a good angle to the keyboard and it feels like really solid. That's my takeaway from my 10-second interaction. Thanks, Joe. But you've probably used one or played with one. You know, how do you feel about this product?
I have, and I'm very excited about it. It's interesting to me, the combination of the premium quality of the device and the positioning of it as such, but then also the idea that it's designed to run a version of Windows that is going to enable a whole new set of experiences and scale and really be something that's going to meet the needs of a lot of markets, including, you know, education, for example. So it feels like a really premium piece of kit, and it feels like I love what they did with the Alcantara on the keyboard, and just like everything that the Surface team does, it has just a really great look and feel and a premium sense to it. So I played with one a little bit longer than you, but not a whole, it's not my main rig right now, but I have had a chance to play with one, and it's you know, I think that what the Surface team has done and what Microsoft has done in hardware in general is to look at the idea of category creation. I mean, this is what we're doing with HoloLens, it's what we did with Surface Pro. This notion that there's a new class of device, and people might say, well, the laptop, that's not a category creation. That's an existing class of device. But I think this particular offering, and with Windows 10S, does establish a new category within that space. And I think for a lot of the folks that this is targeted at, it's going to be a great device. And the other thing that's cool is that this is really in the same way that Surface Pro kind of established that category of the 2-in-1 and spawned the whole ecosystem to do some really exciting stuff. You know, we look forward to the same kinds of things happening broadly around Windows 10S and what can happen there.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the takeaway to me. I mean, laptops are not new, but you guys are kind of putting your own spin on it with the Surface brand and the delightfulness that the Surface brand brings to devices. And you're not cheaping out. And I think, you know, you need to define, especially in this case, since the goal here is to popularize Windows 10S, is you want, like, Pixel did the same for Chromebooks, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very expensive, but also very premium device. And I still use mine because, even though it doesn't do everything I need it to do, and I have a MacBook for that, it still does a lot of what I want it to do. And it is a delightful experience because of the look and feel and the materials, the build quality, and the performance, right? And I think putting Windows S on that is a good way to get people to experience it. And I think Windows S per se is definitely going to get some traction in education and enterprise. I wouldn't be surprised at all. I personally, you know, obviously I'm going to go pro, right? Because I have all the legacy apps I need to run and whatever. But I like the fact that, you know, you made the pro upgrade free and that it's pretty easy to install or upgrade, right? Just a click away. So yeah, I'm looking forward to, I think the Alcantara is going to be kind of a bit of a wild card. I hope it ages well. It doesn't age very well in cars, unfortunately, at least on surfaces you touch. It gets a little hard and brittle over time and it can stain. So I think as long as you keep that surface, pardon the pun, but if you keep that surface clean and oil-free, I mean, you try to basically clean it. It's a synthetic material, so you can use soap to clean it. Very gently with a gentle cloth. I think it'll stay looking fresh. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to getting one. I'm sure you saw my email to your team. I hope that they can send me a device.
I did, I know we've got folks running around.
Sweet, right. Awesome. Along the same lines, I'm very excited about Windows 10 on Snapdragon 835. You know, I wrote a story for ChipChick about it. Not ChipChick, sorry. I wrote the story on MobileGeeks.com.
Yes.
But it's huge, I think, to me. I want to see an always connected, ultra slim, ultra light Windows 10 device because as a tech journalist, I travel a lot and I need the lightest and thinnest. And the Surface, to me, the laptop is going to be great around the house at coffee shops. But I feel like I need something even thinner and lighter and more, with better stamina.
Yep.
And I think that's where I'm very excited about what Qualcomm's announced with the Windows 10. It's funny because it keeps coming up in every podcast. I'm not trying, guys. It's just that I'm really passionate about this. And and actually, I saw you at Computex, Greg. That's when we agreed to have you on the show.
Yes.
We were sitting by the W's swimming pool at the time. It's kind of cool. We were talking exactly about that at the time. I mean, what's your take on that announcement? I think it's super exciting.
I agree. I'm really excited about this. There's a couple of things. I mean, I think for me, as a guy who was part of the airlift of field technical people at Microsoft back in late 1990, when Steve Ballmer flew all of us out up to Redmond and made the announcement that the marquee API and user interface of what we were calling OS 2.0 at the time was going to be Windows, and we were renaming it, and it was going to be this thing called Windows NT, and it was a hardware independent microkernel operating system architecture that was written primarily in C and C++ and had a hardware abstraction layer and was not necessarily tied to any one underlying instruction set. And it was going to run on all these different chip architectures. And it was pretty exciting There's a whole.
I know ARM was a thing on Windows back then, guys.
I don't know that the ARM instruction set was initially in our site.
RISC for sure.
The time. RISC definitely was. We had we supported the MIPS and Alpha, and so there was an array of microprocessor architectures and instruction set that this thing supported. Now it turns out that Intel has done a great job over the ensuing decades, and people forget that the underlying architecture of Windows is hardware independent,
and that's right.
It's only recently that's become, we thought it was going to be potentially more meaningful, certainly in the workstation space, and we saw things like Alpha and MIPS and other architectures and instruction sets kind of go by the wayside. But one of the really cool stories from where I sit is to see, now 25 plus years later, those investments come back to pay off in a whole bunch of ways, including making it easy for us to do the types of systems that you're talking about, these Qualcomm 835 based PCs that run Windows have so many of the advantages that you talk about, the ability to have ridiculous standby power, standby times, to be always connected, to be able to kind of wake up immediately. So the characteristics of the ARM instruction set and of Qualcomm's chips that have led to the success that they've seen in the mobile space are coming to Windows. And there's a couple of really interesting things about the approach here in that, first of all, these devices are going to, be able to connect to a domain and do all of the things from a device management standpoint enterprise-y stuff. And I think that was one of the challenges that we saw initially with Windows RT is that was not the case with that set of devices. The second thing is that really, I mean, the hardware itself has come to a point where the performance characteristics of that SoC are such that the experience, there's no compromises. You can have a really, buttery smooth experience and you don't feel like you're making a sacrifice to gain the advantages of all the standby and the always connected.
Yeah. I mean, the emulation is kind of the critical piece for me. I mean, finally, that's great.
That was the third thing that didn't happen is that, the performance is there. And then now with the emulation, they'd be able to the ability to run Win32 applications. And what people may not understand is that it's just the CPU calls that go through emulation, all of the graphics stack, the memory access, it's not a situation where the entire, the entire application has to go through kind of an emulation layer. So we're,
and it felt fast. I mean,
yeah, that's part of the reason is that, you see the CPU instructions that have to be translated, but for Win32 apps, but the GPU and memory access and everything else just goes native and straight through. So those are among the reasons why the performance is such. And so you put that all together in a package in a lightweight thing with a battery that's going to last a long, long time. And it's a pretty compelling value proposition. I think the other thing from our standpoint it does is you can look at if you look left to right, there's a whole bunch of things that are happening with respect to the developer platform. Those set of devices are going to be really a marquee environment for running universal Windows programs because those, of course, will not go through any emulation and they'll just run natively. The same is true for Windows 10S. And so if you have a Surface laptop, that's going to be a great device to have universal Windows apps that are sandboxed, that have all the security benefits and the update benefits, all of the things that are available with that platform. And then if you look at things like, the mixed reality headsets that are coming out, those those devices will run, those are connected to Windows 10 PCs and it'll run every universal Windows app in the store. So there's a host of things kind of left to right that you look at that take advantage of. It kind of goes back to the discussion we were having earlier about the one core effort is rationalizing the platform across all of this and exposing the consistent APIs to developers across all these devices makes it an even more compelling argument, especially for folks that live kind of in this multi-device world that all of us live in.
For sure. And you know, I mean, I want to remind everybody that the Xbox 360, which is one of the platforms I coded for, was PowerPC based.
Yes.
It wasn't running Windows, of course, at the core, but it was the APIs, the XDK, were very, very similar to the DirectX APIs on Windows at the time. And we could kind of see the foreshadowing of what we're seeing with Windows 10 today, right? Completely different CPU architecture. But in terms of me as a developer writing code for it, you know, it's very similar to writing code for the PC at the time.
Yeah, and there was a common derivation from a kernel standpoint too. There was a little bit more. Those are closer cousins than I think most people realize.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, so it's not a new thing per se. It's just the time has come, I think, to go all out. So we have very little time left. I want to kind of ask you a few things. Because, you know, how often am I going to have you on? Hopefully more. But
yes.
One of the things I want, they're not going to let me get away with not asking you, is about phones and Microsoft. So the elephant in the room question is, will we see another phone from Microsoft? And I realize you might not be able to answer this, but I wanted your take on the state of mobile, like actual handheld physical devices in this Windows 10 rules all world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, I guess my first response is going to be, I have nothing to announce today with respect to any new products, and which is probably going to be an unsatisfying answer. But I think, you know, it's a couple of things. There is an understanding that the state of the world today is a diverse, heterogeneous, multi-device world. And I think one of the exciting changes that I've seen in my, you know, many years at Microsoft is this embracing of that reality. And again, it gets back to this principle of, okay, what is it like to be a customer? What is it like to be the person that's using technology and trying to get all this stuff to work together? Are we going to take a stance that says, no, if you bet on one of our products, you got to bet on all of them. And that kind of all or nothing approach leads to, you know, lock in and people feeling like they don't have the choice that they want and frustration. And so one of the things that has been exciting to see is a reflection of the world that we live in and the world that our customers live in, and an acknowledgement right. that it is a diverse, heterogeneous, multi-device world. And it's incumbent on us as Microsoft has a pretty unique position. I guess you can't really qualify unique, but in any case, we have a position, and it's reflected, I think, in our mission statement. And this idea that we're a company that is relevant to people both at work and at home throughout your whole life. There are many, many people that use our products across their work and home life. And so this idea,
for sure, yeah.
This idea that we want to empower you to achieve things, both, you know, at work and at home, is, you know, part of that is the tacit embracing of this notion that we do live in a heterogeneous device world, and that a lot of our customers who use either, you know, if you use Windows PCs or Xbox or our cloud services or Office are also using a diverse range of devices. So this is, you know, it's a long way of saying that I think there's a good, it's good to recognize that with respect to our applications and our service offerings, but we are still also a platform company. And I think we've had a well-documented kind of refocusing of our efforts in the phone space. We have some unique value that we can deliver to enterprises, certainly. With our mobile offerings today, we have a set of OEMs that are continuing to deliver products based on our platform. One of the things that you'll see us that you do more of is this idea that I referred to earlier of category creation. If you look at, we're trying to not to think about looking back at history and saying, boy, you know, what could we have done? I think we're more interested in looking forward and saying, what are the kinds of things that people will expect from technology in the future?
Yeah.
What are the kinds of scenarios? What are the things that are not possible today that we want to make possible. And one of, you know, so the idea that, you know, your reference to a device that you hold in your hand, which is well understood as a smartphone today.
Correct.
That idea will continue to evolve and the characteristics of that device will change over time. And what are the new things that people will expect and want? And what are the new things that technology advancements will enable? And so we're trying to look forward, not back, and to do a couple of things to embrace that heterogeneous device world that we live in and we acknowledge. But then also to say, look, from a platform perspective, what can we do to make sure that our platform is the best place for developers to invest, the best place for hardware partners to build devices, the best place for end users and customers to take their work and their play. And so that, you know, that's going to kind of free us to be a little bit more creative and flexible. And of course, we've always had the ability to take a bit of a long-term view here. So, you know, I one of the things you had asked me earlier is what phone are you using? I'm still using, I'd switch around between various, I mentioned, you know, the Galaxy S8 and
I wouldn't expect iPhone. Anything else from you,
but I happen to have my trusty Lumia 950, right.
I saw
here.
You use that at Computex and I was like, wow. Awesome.
Yeah. I'm a holdout. You know, one of the things is, and my wife recently bought herself an iPhone. She uh-huh. was excited. And one of the things that she was raving about was her friend was using the Waze app.
Yeah.
But then I was on my way downtown to a Mariners game with my buddy, and he's pointed out the fact that Waze is on Windows Phone, and I didn't realize that.
I didn't know that either.
Everybody was surprised. So I downloaded Waze, and now I've got Waze on my Windows Phone. So, you know, that was one of the reasons, in fact, that my wife got the iPhone, because she was so excited about her girlfriends, ironically. But, you know, again, it's the idea that it's not as much about the endpoints. And I think this is something that has been recognized around here as well, is that let's not fight the last war. You know, let's look ahead. Let's look over the horizon and say, what are the problems that we can solve for people? And if you think about the platform evolution at a kind of a macro scale, the investments that we're making in AI, in mixed reality, in the cloud, these are the kinds of things that are going to pay off big debt dividends. And again, it ties back to this, the investments that we've made in our core platform to enable it to have the flexibility to support just such a incredibly wide array of devices. If you would have told computer scientists 30 years ago that there was a single operating system architecture and a single kernel and a single OS that could run from IoT devices
they wouldn't have believed
game consoles to phones to to clusters of servers doing the biggest compute jobs in the world. They wouldn't have believed you. And I think that the benefits of that we've only just barely begun to see. And it's going to be very interesting to see where this pays off. You know, as you and I have discussed, one of the things I'm spending a lot of my time on these days is our mixed reality.
Let's talk about that. You know, and as an aside, before you go into it, I want to say, you know, I'm very excited to see how Microsoft has evolved over the last few years. With Satya at the helm, the strategy and the vision, I think, are there. And I think it's heading in the right direction. I'm a lot happier with Microsoft as a journalist and a user. I've always been happy as a developer, so I can't complain there. But I think, I want to hear a little bit about what you're working on specifically. Maybe you can start by telling us what you do at Microsoft and how long you've been there, and then segue into what do you do?
Yeah. Well, I am. I work in the Windows and Devices group. I'm in the marketing organization, but I spend most of my time thinking about our mixed reality products and story. And so I think a lot about HoloLens and Windows mixed reality as the operating system elements that enable the new headsets from our partners that'll be coming out later this year. So I work with the teams that feed back into engineering product requirements from multiple input channels from and customers to channel partners, OEMs and ODMs, the press, you know, folks like you. And we manage kind of inbound and outbound communication around how do we build products that meet the needs of our customers, and then how do we communicate the benefits of those, and so people understand what we have. And so lately, I've been spending a lot of time in this mixed reality space, and it started, of course, with Microsoft HoloLens, and really the inflection point happened almost exactly a year ago. It was at Computex. You and I were just at Computex, A year before that, I was also at Computex, and it was
me too.
It was the point at which there you were there too. It was the point at which we announced that the software that enables Microsoft HoloLens is coming to every version of Windows 10 and every Windows 10 PC, and we're going to enable our partners to build these headsets that run essentially the same software that runs HoloLens. And one of the interesting things that happened to me a year ago when we made that announcement was some folks asked me, boy, when did you guys change your strategy and decide to, you know, take this HoloLens software and apply it to the platform broadly? And the answer is this was always the strategy. We hadn't talked about it. We initially unveiled HoloLens, a little over a year before that. And then we shipped HoloLens in March of last year. And then in June, we said, oh, yeah, by the way, the software that enables HoloLens is coming to every Windows 10 PC, and you'll be able to buy affordable headsets that deliver a mixed reality experience. One of the things that has happened since then that I frankly have been on a bit of a personal mission to try and clarify is folks have pointed out, they say, well, you know, those headsets they're VR headsets. And HoloLens, well, it's really an AR device, and you guys are muddying the waters. And I think one of the things that we're trying to point out to people is that we take a holistic view of the entire continuum from physical reality to virtual reality. If you really go left to right from the 100% real to the 100% virtual.
I mean, that's the only way you can do that.
Exactly. And there's a couple of unique things about our approach that I think will end up making a big difference once people really begin to realize this. And that is that we don't think about the VR space and the AR space as separate platforms are separate things. We see them as part of a continuum that is enabled by our underlying software platform. Windows Mixed Reality runs on the HoloLens. It's a self-contained holographic computer. It runs these incredible, you know, volumetric 3D holographic applications. The Windows 10 PC that you'll connect one of these new headsets to also runs the Windows Mixed Reality software. It'll run every universal Windows app in the store and these new volumetric applications. Yes, it doesn't have a see-through lens, but it is delivering the same kind of software platform and the same experience. And one of my favorite, and this is where the light bulb kind of went off for a lot of people at our Build conference, and I don't know if you got a chance to go through the Holographic Academy and to
I did. It was cool.
Yeah, so that the point at which you go through that island puzzle game, that collaborative experience where you have, you know, one person wearing a HoloLens and another person wearing one of these occluded headsets, which, you know, is more of a VR type of experience.
Right.
But you realize that you're both running the same application and you're collaborating in real time in mixed reality, not just on devices from different manufacturers of the same type, but of two essentially fundamentally different types of devices. One of them, an included tethered headset, and one of them, this self-contained transparent one. And I think there's no better kind of demonstration or proof of this idea that we look holistically across that whole continuum and say, look, there's not going to be this world where you use one operating system or one set of experiences or one platform developed for VR and a different one for AR. We're saying they're all part of this same mixed reality spectrum. Windows addresses and enables devices across that whole array, and that you should be able to run existing apps, collaborate. Today, if you have an Oculus Rift and I have a Vive, we most likely can't even play a game against each other.
I know, and it's sad. It's kind of like the siloization of VR, right?
Exactly. And we think it's the role of the operating system to abstract the differences in hardware implementations from different manufacturers, provide a consistent interface that developers can write to enable an experience so that we can, if you have a Dell headset and I have a Acer headset and my friend has a HoloLens, we should all be able to go to the store, download the app, and go, you know, play the
game. And have fun together.
Yeah.
And play Forza 7 together.
Exactly.
Listen, on that note, I want to ask you one last thing because we need to wrap it up. But I want to ask if you have an anecdote you can share with us. You've been at Microsoft, what, 30 years?
Almost. It'll be 28 years in October. So
28 years. Yeah. And I want to know if you have any stories to share with potentially some folks that are no longer there, that have been significant contributors. I mean, if you feel comfortable. It doesn't have to involve any folks either. It can just be like some fun Microsoft story to leave us.
Well,
with.
There's one story that came to mind, and when you first mentioned this, and that was it happened to be about Steve Ballmer, and this is actually still, there's a transcript of this still, I believe, up on the Microsoft website somewhere. So I don't think I'm cool. Kind of
you're not in trouble.
Hopefully not breaking into jail on this.
The PR police is not going to come knock on your door.
No, it just talks to the kind of guy Steve Ballmer is as well. He was amazing to work with. But there was I believe it was a Comdex, actually, years ago. And
I remember
Comdex. Comdex. Yeah. And
yeah.
There was a
people here weren't born. Many listeners. It's okay.
Yes,
don't worry.
You kids don't remember this show that used to be called Comdex. And Bill Gates gave the keynote. And I remember I wasn't planning to go, but I got asked to come and. We were just about to launch Windows XP, I believe. And I got asked to come and do a demo on stage with Steve Ballmer to show off some of the new features in Windows XP. And so I came down to Comdex and Bill Gates was given the keynote, and Bill Gates was poking a little bit of fun at Steve Ballmer in that keynote. And he showed a video with Steve running around on stage, screaming developers, developers, developers.
Yes.
And then they would quick cut to a chimpanzee jumping around, and then quick cut back to Steve. And Bill made a joke about Monkey Boy, and you know, Steve took it all in stride. And so as I got on stage the next day to give the Windows XP demonstration, with Steve, it was such a short time turnaround that we didn't even have a chance to rehearse the demo. We just we just kind of made it up as we went along. So we had sent around a little outline, and I said, okay, Steve, this is what we're going to show. We're going to flip through some fast user switching. We're going to show the new Luna UI of Windows XP. We're going to and then we're going to show Windows Messenger. And right. Right before I went on stage, I turned to my friend and I said, how much you give me if I call him Monkey Boy? And she and she laughed at me and said, yeah, right. And so I got up on stage and I'm going into the Windows Messenger demo, and there's two PCs set up, and Steve and I are going to IM each other. And I'm talking about this new thing, you know, IM instant messaging, and it's now built into Windows. And I said, it's like the CB craze back in the 70s where you had a handle, you know, hey, rubber ducky or whatever. And people have these IM handles as well. And I said, I happen to know Steve's IM handle. And so I type into the machine, hi, Monkey Boy. And Steve, and we hadn't rehearsed this. And so Steve, to his credit, he kind of stands, he folds his arm, and he looks at me with that Steve Ballmer look, that intimidating look. And he said something like, you know, no, keep going. And, he took it with great humor, and it ended up being a really fun demo. And he kind of played into it and threatened that he was going to fire me. And just took it really, really well, and was a great sport about it. So I guess I rolled the dice a little bit, but I knew that.
Yeah.
I guess I felt emboldened by Bill's ability to make fun of him in the keynote, and then Steve was a great sport about it, and so that was a memorable moment in my Microsoft career.
He kind of had to own it at that point, anyway, right? I mean.
He did. I mean, it was in Bill's keynote, and he's jumping
right.
around.
Bill had said it, you know, no going back now.
That's kind of cool. What gave me free rein. Yeah.
Well, listen, Greg, thanks for being on the show. Do you want to plug your various social media channels and tell people where they can find you if they want to follow you?
Oh, sure. I am at Greg Wardo on Twitter.
That's right.
I'm a infrequent tweeter, but a frequent lurker, and so that's where I can be found. And I think obviously all the various Microsoft channels folks know about, and those are good ones to stay up to date on the latest and greatest around here.
Yeah, definitely Google Greg Sullivan for a bunch of interesting interviews I've done in the past and other stuff. He's out there. And again, thanks, Greg, for being on the show. This was really awesome. Really unique perspective on the industry from you. We'll have to have you come again sometime.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And thank you so much.
All right, I'm going to let you guys know where to find me. I'm on Twitter as Tankgirl, TNKGRL. Of course, you can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Google Plus if you use that sort of thing. I'm also, my YouTube channel is youtube.com/Miriam Joar. That's my full name, as you'll find it on Twitter, in case you don't know how to spell it. And I do unboxings, I do review videos, I do all kinds of fun videos there. You can read my phone reviews on chipchick.com and my industry coverage sometimes on Mobile Geeks, primarily during trade shows. Stay tuned to the podcast, subscribe, tell your friends. I would say like, but this isn't YouTube, so you can't like. Stay tuned for next week. And again, thanks, Greg, and we'll talk to you all later.
This has been the Mobile Tech Podcast with Tank Girl, proudly presented by worldpodcasts.com. You can visit us online at mobiletechpodcast.com.